the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's a couple of minutes after 9 a.m., February the 16th. I'm joined today by my co-chair, Senator Stedman, Senator Ellis. Senator Olson is on a plane flying in this morning. He had meetings out in Hooper Bay. Senator McGuire, Senator Regan, Senator Thomas. Unlike my co-chairman, I'm not Senator Thomas, my name is Senator Hoffman. Today we are here to review, get an overview from university's budget, FY12 operating budget. We're going to have the presentation by President Pat Campbell. On your table, you have a binder with various operating reports from OMB and Ledge Finance and handouts from the University of Alaska to go along with today's presentation. Mr. Gamble, welcome to the Senate Finance Committee, and please identify yourself and introduce anyone that you want to assist you today. We'll have it as a very informal presentation, and members can be identified and ask questions as we proceed. Mr. President.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Pat Gamble, President of the University of Alaska System. I have with me Michelle Rizik, who is our Chief Budget Officer, Wendy Redman, Executive Vice President of the System, and online we have Kit Duke, who is our Facilities Director this morning. What we'd like to do is, as the Chairman said, give you a brief overview of the budget. I'll tell you a little bit about this budget. It's probably different than the ones that you've seen over the past several years. It's significantly lower in terms of the operating side, in terms of the ask. The capital side is significantly different in that we're not asking for any new projects, not asking for any new planning money for projects. We're basically taking the GO bond projects that we have, what we currently have under construction. That's a fairly full plate, but the focus is going to be on the deferred maintenance. The reason I mentioned that in an O&M briefing is because we are in the process of finding ourselves taking significant amounts of dollars from our O&M and putting them toward deferred maintenance fixes on things that are breaking down on the capital side. And so there's a relationship between the two that we're going to try to get back to where it belongs and put O&M into operating maintenance in the year of execution and not have to feed it into the capital side. So our capital budget and our O&M budget this year are quite related in a way that they haven't been in the past. But we will talk about the O&M budget today. I'll be happy to answer any questions about the capital budget as you see fit. You have before you a short briefing. I'm on slide number 2, the state policy guidance. I took this from the governor's letter to the departments, which came to us, and paraphrased the four items that I saw in his letter that were the guidance that we were to follow in building our budget this year. When we use the term student success in the governor's letter, he says mission accomplishment. Student success really is the essence of our mission. By success, we mean the idea that a student who enters into our system has some idea of where they want to go. They want to get a certificate, they want to get a license, a two-year degree, a four-year degree, or an advanced degree. That's success by definition, and so that's what we mean by student success. Service to the state. Our university, as opposed to many universities in the lower 48, is basically a university that takes its students in quite an open enrollment fashion and then turns them back into the job market and the workforce in the state at all levels. And that and economic development that's associated with that process is service to the state as we see it. Slide number 3. The university is still growing. It has for the last 10 years, and I think this body has been very generous in assisting that growth in terms of programs and in terms of facilities. I would not say that growth is an objective of ours at this particular time. Growth in the physical plant I'm talking about. As I said before, we have a lot on our plate with regard to the physical plant. But we're also very mindful of the fact that we may be facing some years where the budget's going to have to flatten out. The governor's guidance basically told us again that this was to be a maintenance type budget. And so while we're experiencing growth, as it's shown on this chart, we're also in the process of trying to figure out how to flatten the budget and still take in the number of students that are beating on the door for all kinds of programs. And this chart is designed to just give you an example of what we're seeing over the last couple of years. A chart number four, we just crossed 34,000 for total enrollment. That's all types of students in our system. And that's a high water mark. Chart number five, this is the budget we're requesting. The tuition, as you know, we had a raise in tuition recently. There were numerous articles written about it. It was a fairly modest raise. Of course, if you're the one that's getting the raise, it isn't modest. It's a raise. But if you look at it in the context of overall across the United States, across the country, we're one of the lowest tuitions for a four-year degree anywhere in the country, and we'd like to keep it that way.
On that slide, on the blue book, you have the number correct for the personnel of $505 million, but under other, I guess, the total amount you have is $879.9, and here it says $885, which is $85 million. Different from the book that you presented here, and if you don't have the information on that, I would like to get from you what the differences are from your one-page presentation and a more detailed presentation that has an amount from the first page of $85 million higher.
If I could ask our budget officer to explain that, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Hoffman, what we presented here is what was in the Board of Regents budget in for the total ask, and the number that you're referring to is what's being supported in the governor's budget.
Okay. Thank you. Because I thought that we had made that clear when we were having presentations here. It wasn't going to be presentations of what the Board of Regents wanted. It's what the governor was supporting. And that was as a result of a meeting that we had up in Fairbanks, I believe, two summers ago.
Okay. I'll make a note of that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Chart number six. Wanted to make mention of the guidance that we received with regard to our O&M budget. And we're in the process of complying with the first bullet. As you know, or may remember, that ratio of 129 is really a ratio of two numbers that are 2 years apart. It was actual receipts from 2 years ago versus this year's, and that's the ratio formula that we're living with. If we actually looked at this year's estimated receipts and this year's estimated expenses, we would be right at 129, but actually the formula is separated by 2 years. We made a nice bid toward that in the right direction. The House indicated that they were quite happy with the progress that we had made in 1 year. And as I said, this budget is probably the smallest that we've brought you in 5 years. And so we are moving as best we can toward the 129 and ultimately toward the 125 that you see on here. There's some difficulties with that formula, nevertheless, is still an objective that we're trying to achieve. And then I think in the second bullet, we have complied with the intent of the legislature on the second bullet and reported back on that.
Yes, Michelle.
Mr. Chairman, if I may make just a brief statement about the second intent language item. That was an item that the Senate put in, and that was in response to the multiple appropriation structure. It was to help the university provide some level of flexibility, because with the multiple appropriation structure, we weren't able to move funds between appropriations. So by putting those funds in our system-wide budget and reductions account, it gave the university the ability to move funds that were necessary between appropriations as the board and president found necessary. So that's worked quite well. The general fund amount equaled about $10 million, and so having that in April, we ended up distributing the majority of that, all but about $1 million of that, back to the campuses. We retained $1 million of that and worked with the each of the campuses to determine what their high priority needs were to allocate the $1 million toward, and it went toward things that were priorities that weren't funded in the legislature's budget. In regard to receipt authority, the amount of federal receipts that was put in the system-wide budget and reductions was not sufficient, and so as part of the FY11 supplemental budget, we requested additional federal funds for Anchorage campus because of the increase in Pell activity. UAA has not had enough federal receipt authority, and so I believe through the supplemental budget and then the requested increase in federal funds as part of the FY12 budget for federal receipts, that will address the issue that we had with that.
Well, that, you know, the Finance Committee had worked with the university. In the past, we've had VRUs that had no flexibility, and as a result of discussions of what the needs are, the Finance Committee agreed, and we negotiated with the House to, as you said, to give a 3% flexibility to the university so that they had the ability, but the committee was most interested in seeing where those transfers took place, and I've received, and you had the deadline of February 1st, which you met, to give that report to the legislature, and I've reviewed it, and I appreciate the report and the comments, and I was wondering what dialogue this process or this budgeting process received at the Board of Regents.
I have not had a lot of experience with the board in terms of the extent of the dialogue, but in the couple of times I've heard them talk about this in passing in short discussions, I think it was received pretty well, Mr. Chair. I think the ability to move that money and the degrees of freedom it gave took away a problem, and I think the board was appreciative of the ability to be able to support that.
And for everyone's information, this was primarily put in place so that the different campuses and as well as the rural campuses would be assured that the appropriation process that we acted upon at this table assured those areas that they would get those dollars in their regions, and that I think is something that we wanted to assure the various areas of the region of the state that happened. And I'm appreciative of the fact that we were able to move from complete BRUs and keep the BRU system the way it is, plus giving the university the 3% flexibility as long as we were given the report. And this is the first year that happened, and I'm appreciative that happened, and appreciative of the report and the fact that the system seems to be working. Please proceed, Mr. President.
If we can go to slide number 7. This is a graphic just to kind of give you a comparison between what was authorized in 10 and 11 with what we're proposing in 12. Under state funds, you'll notice the blue line, FY12 line proposed, grows a little bit. That's almost exclusively in contractual pay raises and the increased cost of health care that accounts for that growth over FY11 and 10. University receipts are up. Federal receipts are up a little bit. University receipts are up basically because of tuition increases. That's the largest single one there.
Can you comment upon the tuition increases last year as proposed this year?
Last year meaning 11, FY11?
And what's being contemplated for 12?
Why don't you take that one?
Mr. Chairman, the Board of Regents just approved the FY13, we try to approve the tuition increases with as much advance notice as possible for the students so they can plan accordingly. So for FY13, the Board of Regents just approved those at the December, I believe it was the December board meeting, with a 7% increase for 100 to 400 levels and then a 3% increase for graduate level. We worked with the Coalition of Student Leaders and a tuition task force to determine those rates, and that's where we ended for FY13.
And how does that compare with FY12?
For FY12, the tuition rate increase was 5% for lower division and 10% for upper division.
Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. President.
On slide number 8, a couple of notables that I put here on this chart to look into the budget a little bit. When we talked about the increase in compensation on the previous chart, the average over the last few years, FY08 to 11, we've been coming in at about 4% across the unions and the staff, averaging about 4% for compensation increases. Or what we're looking at this year, we're in the middle of negotiations. We've negotiated with one of our unions. We're in the process of negotiating with a couple more right now. So far, we're somewhere in the 2% area as opposed to the 4% area. And I think that's reflective of the realization across the board that the economic conditions and the cost of living and so on and so forth are what they are, and they've been very reasonable in the negotiations to acknowledge that with us.
And those are requested in the as supplementals to the operating budget this year?
We don't have all the negotiations done, and so when we complete the succeeding negotiations, and we probably have, I think, three more to go, we'll have to insert those into the budget. But they're coming in, and this chart is designed to kind of let you know at about where they're coming in. So we've got a wedge built into the budget there that estimates that it's going to be somewhere in this neighborhood for our estimation purposes, and to be able to round out the whole budget. But we have not concluded those negotiations yet.
Thank you.
Fixed costs are down. They're down significantly, and that's an effort that we've undergone throughout the entire system just to go after extraneous costs, particularly those that are discretionary and controllable at the campus level. And the campus directors and the chancellors have done a great job at working that down. And then program requests are down significantly. As you can see, we're not in a period of time when we're apt to be adding new programs. As I said before, on the capital side, we're not adding new buildings. On the program side, we're not adding new programs. In fact, we will probably undertake quite an extensive program review as part of our strategic planning process, which we're just kicking off now. And we could possibly see that change even more. Slide 9, I made that comment to you previously. Slide 10, I think the takeaway on this slide, if you look at the far right bar, you'll notice that the fixed cost increase compared to the previous years and the program dollars compared to the previous years are significantly down, and the bulk of that is, of course, then remaining is the compensation piece. So this is just a graphic representation of kind of what I've been saying over the last couple slides.
And it might be noted that we have seen substantial increases to the university's budget, and many people at this table felt that those increases were unsustainable at those levels. So I think that the direction that the governor is giving the university is in line with what many members of this finance committee and the other finance committee agree with.
Mr. Chairman, if you'll note on this chart, for comparison purposes, as you mentioned in your previous comment, we did compare the governor's request to the governor's appropriation. So this does match with the number that you referred to previously of the governor's budget. So we did listen for this chart.
Thank you, Michelle.
Yes.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe we could have them highlight a little bit more on the fluctuating fixed cost changes and then blend in their presentation some comments concerning the recent report that was done on the university's systems and their overhead and how they plan on dealing with that going forward.
Did you hear that?
I didn't hear all
that. Can you repeat that, Senator?
In the chart here, there's fluctuations in the fixed costs. Like a little more elaboration on the fixed costs, the flexibility within the fixed costs. And then there's another a question, Mr. Chairman, would be to weave in some comments to the presentation concerning the report that was out here a few weeks ago dealing with the efficiencies at the university and how they plan on responding to that report.
The fixed costs that come to mind immediately are things like travel. The travel budget for the university, for example, is quite a large account. Reduction in travel, reduction in certain services, reduction in contracts, reduction in utilities. We've done some utility savings that have all contributed to bringing down those fixed costs. And Michelle, you might be able to go into more detail.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, I'd also add on there, we only have the health sciences new facility coming online this year, and what we've done in response to discussions with the legislature is we've split apart what the programmatic piece is of the new facility versus what the operating costs are of the new facility. So what's represented here is just the cost to operate the health sciences building, and then the programmatic needs for that facility are part of the program request versus in previous years under the fixed cost item, you would have seen the programmatic cost and the cost to operate the facility as part of that fixed cost category. So we've separated those out, and that's reduced what the fixed cost amount is.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stedman.
Just looking or reflecting back over the last several years, we've had quite a bit of dialogue at the table versus what the actual fixed cost of the university is or is not. And we've had some debate and discussion on that. But to me, travel doesn't seem like a fixed cost. It seems more like a variable cost. So I guess I'm struggling with the definition again of fixed costs. Fixed cost to me is something that's fairly inflexible and generally speaking, can't be avoided from budget year to budget year.
Well,
Mr. President,
I note the point. And I guess technically in the definition, yeah, you would be right. If we wanted to talk about the fixed plant fixed cost, in the long run, everything's a variable cost. What I was referring to basically, though, was the discretionary kinds of costs, which in my lexicon, and not necessarily in Michelle's, in the budget world, in my lexicon, are the ones that I'm going after to try to reduce. And represented in the discretionary area, which to me falls in this fixed cost bracket, are the things that I mentioned. Now, the way Michelle categorizes it, or you categorize it as an absolute fixed cost, I would agree with you.
Okay. And then can we, as they feel comfortable rolling through the presentation, reference that report that was out before we're done today?
You want to comment upon the report that was out that I think it was first mentioned in the House Finance Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That we refer to that as the Fisher Report. It's commonly being called the Fisher Report by Dr. Fisher, who is the team leader. This was a system-wide report, the first one that's been done system-wide, I think, in quite a while for the university. We've had some other reports that have been more narrowly focused. But the Fisher Report, with the help of the Rasmussen Foundation, who actually picked up about 90% of the cost, was a system-wide look by a team of five very highly placed educators who have probably done somewhere in the neighborhood of, I mean, from the list that I saw, I would guess there were well over 100 universities that they've done this for over the years. And we asked them to go wall-to-wall and take a blinders-off look at our system. What this report really is, the cover letter, as I wrote it to everybody to try to understand what they were and weren't seeing, was it wasn't a prescription. It wasn't a blueprint to follow. As Wendy likes to say, it wasn't a Fisher says kind of thing, and we're going to respond to every single item. What they did was, in a lot of cases, they said, you guys do it this way. Everybody else does it this way. You might want to take a look at the way you're doing this and ask yourself why, or look and see if there's not a better application for the way you do a certain function. There were a lot of those. There were a lot of accolades. They said, you're doing things that are really working pretty good. There were a few places where they said, we just don't agree with the way you're doing things. So out of a 100-page document, we are in the process right now. In fact, after I leave this meeting and go back to Anchorage, I will have another meeting with the chancellors and the provosts in setting up an institutional approach toward taking the Fisher Report, our newly published academic master plan for the system, and aligning the data that we've received over the last 2 or 3 years in these plans, and then put together our 5-year plan, and the Fisher Report's going to be a foundation in that. So we will use that document, but it isn't prescriptive, and some of the things that Fisher has put in there just flat don't fit for Alaska. They're fine for the lower 48, and I would say that giving that team who's never been up here a little bit of latitude to not understand us in the short time they were here is probably okay. But to the degree that there was a lot of that in the report, there actually wasn't that much. The report actually was well received. It was well received by the board, and it was pretty well received by our chancellors and faculty and staff as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Stedman.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
On slide 11, again, we talked about costs and cost cutting. This is an example of some of the areas that, a continuation of the last question, some of the areas that we looked into and were able to find savings. I mentioned utilities. It's interesting to note that bottom one. $43,000 doesn't seem like a lot in a large budget like this, but to a local campus, that's actually hard to do, and it's quite notable. The bad news is UAF the other day had a boiler problem and had to shut down, and for 3 days they had to maintain the boiler and buy an extra 5 megawatts off the market at 19 cents versus 4 cents, which is what we generated at. And it increased the cost $27,000 a day for the 3 days that they were working. So you work real hard to get some savings like this, and then you see it blown away by virtue of the fact that that maintenance costs can eat that right up, and the price of energy on the market is pretty high.
I'm well aware of that, price of energy. Senator Stedman.
While we're on that subject of the cost of energy, can you give us a ballpark figure of your cost of generating power? And if you don't have that to the university, you can get back to the committee. It wraps up into a lot of other energy issues dealing with Fairbanks, not only the cost of electricity, but the cost of heating your plant and equipment.
I'll be happy to provide for the record the actual data, but anecdotally, I can tell you that I've personally crawled through that plant, every square inch of it. And they have it monitored so that you can look on screens and see in real time the actual cost per boiler as you're looking at it, and whether it's burning coal or whether it's burning heating oil or whether you're buying electricity off the grid, we can actually add up those individual costs literally in real time and see what we're spending in real time. Now, to aggregate those costs and give you a monthly cost or an annual cost, we'll get that information for you. But that's how well it's monitored.
Senator Stedman.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as a clarification, as the point of the question wasn't really, the dollars that the university is spending, which of course is a concern here at the table in general, but more of a comparative cost between the different energy sources, so we can integrate that into the other work that we do here at the table, dealing with the energy solution for Anchorage, MATSU, and the Fairbanks issue.
Yes, we will give you those costs. And like I said, on that monitor, it actually has that number on there, and it's multiplying it times the number of BTUs you're burning. So we'll get you those numbers.
Thank you. And I've had several dialogues with Chancellor Rogers regarding that coal-fired plant that is very, very old, and what the university is contemplating for replacing that facility, and he's well aware of it and looking at that along with other requests that I've made of the university regarding nuclear power, small nuclear power plants for use in the state, and that's going to be addressed later by this committee, but thank you for that, Senator Stedman.
I'm on slide 12. I might mention, speaking of costs, and I know you all are aware of this, but we've had a consultant come in and look at our health care cost growth, and we mentioned the term unsustainable earlier in the meeting. That is an unsustainable cost growth. We have to offset in FY12 an increase in our health care of an estimated $7 million plus just in 12, and then in 13, it's more than that. It's probably 10 million more in 13. These are unsustainable costs. We are taking action internally to redo our entire health care program for our employees to try to offset for 12 that $7 million. The kinds of actions that we're contemplating and that we have a committee that's made up of our staff and our employees, representatives from across the system. The kinds of things they're looking at just a couple of years ago would have been considered draconian, and today they're considered pretty average to the kinds of things that companies and universities are having to do to offset healthcare. But despite that, if I can find $7 million to offset the issue for healthcare, I don't know how when I take that, I'm going to find $10 million more the following year and how many million more the following year after that. So this is a problem that I don't necessarily have an answer to, but it's not just, of course, the university. It's affecting all of us. On slide 12, as I mentioned before, we are deferring. This is just a glimpse at the capital. We have an idea to go after deferred maintenance. The power plant has significant deferred maintenance issues in it, as an example. And on our capital side, we're actually proposing trying to break the cycle of deferred maintenance, which is increasing every single year, and get it back down to something we can deal with. So that's an element of our overall budget that is not in O&M, but O&M would be benefited by that because of the amount that we have to take and put into the capital side. And then what we'd like to propose is to try to find a way and work with the legislation to find an acceptable way to get to a sustainable point and then maintain a sustainable point where we don't go back to the level of deferred maintenance that we're facing right now, which is north of $800 million.
Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to back up for 1 second, two things. On slide 11, where you mentioned the $43,000 per year savings, was that basically attributed to the community technical center? Is that that retrofit of that?
Yes.
And that's just one building, basically.
Right.
That, although it was a relatively expensive fix, that's an enduring cost savings over a long period of time. And also, if I may, when you get back to the chairman and the committee on the situation with the power plant, would you make sure it's very clear that that's a district heat power plant for those that are not that familiar with it, so that when we discuss that, we'll have a full understanding of the use of that power plant, not just creating electricity, but the district heat.
It's
for
a cogen plant, that's correct. And not only that, but our water system runs through the same facility. So if the plant goes down, it's a single point failure problem. If the plant goes down, our water system goes down, for example. It's all contained in the same complex when it was built. And not only that, but a lot of our fiber optic, or not fiber optic, but a lot of our web connections that go out to our community campuses actually funnel through that plant too, because there's a great big electrical grid box system also contained within that plant. Now, some of the money that you all have given us in the past, we're trying to break some of that out and actually relocate it. And there's a couple of projects, electrical projects, underway right now that are quite expensive that are going to take some of that single point failure risk out of that one complex. But the boilers are still the old boilers, and the water plant isn't going to move. And so it's the single highest risk item we have in our system, as judged by our risk office. And the chairman is exactly right. It's going to have to be dealt with here in the next couple of years.
A comprehensive look at that, so we can assess that in relation to Senator Stedman's question. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Thomas.
We're on slide 13.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Senator Ellis, sorry about that.
Thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Senator Hoffman, Mr. Gamble, on slide 12, the first bullet there, deferring new construction and planning dollars, how does that square with the pressing need for expanded engineering programs at both the Fairbanks and Anchorage campuses? Does this mean we're derailed in that regard, or how does this bullet square with what we hope to accomplish in growing our own engineers here in the state?
Yes, good question. What we have on the books right now in progress will remain in progress, and engineering is one of those things. In fact, I just had a conversation with the advisory board for engineering yesterday, and they're going to address our board meeting tomorrow. But there are some what I call counter-cyclical demands on the university that even if we flatten our budget and try to hold growth down, there are certain demands on the university that are so pressing and so immediate for the state that those are probably not going to be categories where we're going to go in and try to cut programs. For example, teacher education is one. For example, health and health science is one. Engineering is one, and then we're going to go after and be much more aggressive on research. I think we've got much more opportunity to bring in research to the state than we have, and we've got a brand new leadership team in research in UAF, and we intend to do that. So those programs, I think, are going to be solid, and in fact, if we do have to cut back in the future and we have to collapse around a core of interest to the university and to the state, then those items are probably going to be components of that core, and engineering is in there. I just talked to Exxon a couple of days ago. The demand for engineers will remain high in Alaska, as we all know, and we intend to try to meet that demand. That's going to require growth in engineering.
When was this dialogue with Exxon regarding additional growth for engineers? Because I think we're getting mixed messages from the industry.
The industry will, I think, if the message is not mixed, I think what the industry will say is they can get baccalaureate graduates. They've got 16,000 engineers in Exxon. What they have a hard time getting, though, is master's and PhDs. And there are not a lot of foundation-type programs that give scholarships or money to post-grad. And
I guess my question is, are they requesting those engineers because they see additional demand for new engineers in the field?
Yes. They have a demand for new engineers in the field. Now, if they don't expand, I mean, if business stops for them, obviously that demand would change. But what they're telling us, what their foundation is telling us, and of course this is Exxon trying to give money to the university to create engineers, particularly out of our native schools, out of our native Alaskan schools, and we're very hard at work trying to work that as a sort of subset of a bigger issue. But nevertheless, the NSEP program, for example, is turning out engineers, and they're getting hired, and Exxon is very interested in continuing that.
Well, that is why this committee added another $1 million to the NSEP program that wasn't requested by the board or the university or the administration. The program is highly successful. But to follow up on Senator Ellis's question, on page 29 of the Blue Book report, you highlight the high-demand job degrees, and we see the increase in the targets for 12 to approach 3,000, which is up over 750 from 2006. And the areas are in health, engineering, and construction. And I guess my question is regarding health and particularly the nursing program. I've met with individuals from the University of Alaska, Anchorage, and they are having an overabundance of applications in Anchorage and in Fairbanks. And as a result, we're getting the indication that many of those individuals are moving out to rural areas of the state and competing for those nursing jobs, particularly in the Kuskokwim campus. And the thrust of initiating that program was that we would educate and train nurses, and they would stay in the region. And the ones that have received their degrees are staying. So the end result is that health care will improve in rural Alaska with a less turnover in educating rural nurses that are born and raised there. So with this additional demand, I know that this is a flat budget, but is there, with additional funding, if this committee so chose, is there areas of increasing in this particular nursing program? Because we hear that nurses are short, the demand is there, and as you said in your remarks regarding insurance costs, health costs are continuing to increase, but are we training enough individuals in this particular area to meet the demands?
Mr. Chair, if I might call on Wendy Redmond, she has a lot more background information on this subject than I have gathered in my 9 months, and might provide you a better answer.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to tread on dangerous territory here because I would have to
identify yourself for the record, please.
Oh, sorry, sir. My name is Wendy Redmond, Executive Vice President for the University. A little dangerous territory because I'd have to reference the not blue book. And in
please proceed.
The Board of Regents did request to the governor some very high priority programs, particularly in health care. And one of them was a request for $311,000, I believe, for the Native Nursing Program. So if it was the will of the committee to try to support additional programs in health sciences, there are requests from the university, from the Board of Regents, that I think would be certainly welcomed.
Thank you. Are there further questions on this issue? I will be meeting with you to bring those before the committee at a later point. Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the same issue persists here in Southeast Alaska as well, to train nurses for our region. We start them here.
Senator, can you speak into the mic, please?
I'm sorry. Sorry, Mr. Chair. Same issue persists here in Southeast Alaska, too. We start training nurses to complete in Anchorage, but a lot of these nurses stay in the region or go to the smaller communities in Southeast Alaska. That those positions are vitally needed right now. And, Mr. Chair, one more question as long as I have. I guess the issue about deferring new construction worries me because we have a dire issue here with new housing that we need for freshmen that come into our Southeast campus from throughout the region, and we're at capacity, have been at capacity. And I was just wondering where expansion of the Banfield Hall or any new housing construction fits in your plans for us for Southeast. And one more before you answer it. I look at deferred maintenance and the R&R, and I see statewide there's almost $1.2 billion of deferred maintenance in R&R. However, Southeast Alaska, the general campus at least, total only $15 million. And that seems a little a little weak for my campus.
Mr. President.
Mr. Chair, if I may answer the first one, Senator, of the housing. Here in UAS, when I went over and looked at the housing, I could see right away that they were at capacity, and of course they're moving juniors and seniors out of the housing and moving freshmen in, and clearly they're at capacity here, and of course the difficulty in absorbing in the neighborhood at a price that students can afford, you know, those that can't live on the campus is exacerbated by the demand. We have just been looking at a public-private partnership opportunity that I think is going to be discussed with the board at the board meeting. We have, as I mentioned, Kit Duke, our facilities director, online. She just emailed me this morning about some real interesting occurrences that she's observed with regard to advancements in public-private housing, specifically by companies who do student housing. And we're seriously looking at it, and if we would like to hear from her on this a little bit more, I would be happy to suggest we call her up.
She's online.
Kit, are you online?
I am here, yes. What I was relating to...
Can you identify yourself for the record, please?
Oh, sorry. This is Kit Duke, Facilities Director for the University. What I was relating to President Gamble was the fact that I have information from other universities about how they have successfully used public-private partnerships to produce housing in an economic climate where it's very difficult to get state general fund dollars to address this particular need. And so we are talking with the three MAUs, but particularly UAF and UAS, about some form of this technique and trying to come up with a model that will be successful in Alaska. One of the challenges, of course, is that our construction costs are a lot higher than they are in the lower 48 per bid. And so we have to, look at how we can try to contain those costs but still provide a unit that's going to be acceptable to students. But I think it offers a positive opportunity to try to do this without a big infusion of state money. And I'd be happy to provide additional information at some point in time.
Senator Regan.
Thank you, Kit. And if you can provide that to the committee, that'll be very helpful. Thank you, Mr.
Senator
Chair.
Regan, Senator Thomas, and Senator Sedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've had discussions recently with this is regarding nurses. The Department of Labor and AvTech is taking up some training of nurses. They've been doing some training, and they're looking at some other. And we encourage them to work, obviously, with the university and also make sure that they are assessing the different categories of nurses that exist and making sure that when we're creating a supply that it is the one that is the most urgent or critical need, particularly in the rural area. So hopefully that is what we're doing, and then concentrating on fulfilling that need. And then just one other thing that you may want to comment is that last year we, many around this table, supported a capital budget that we thought was important to prop up the economy somewhat, and we allocated roughly $35 million for deferred maintenance at the university. And just a quick comment on that from you, if possible. How do you see that flowing into the economy as far as in respect to local contractors getting that work? Because we anticipate that those smaller projects would be more readily garnered by smaller contracts in these local areas.
Mr. President.
Senator, on the first item, I've had occasion now to talk to Commissioner Bishop two or three times. In fact, I had lunch with him on this very subject the other day to try to get AvTech and the university together, talk closer to figure out what they can do best and what we can do best and not try to overlap our programs. He's more than willing to go forward on that basis, and I intend to do that. You put your finger on another important item. Just cranking out nurses is not the name of the game. Trying to fill the right spots in the right places, as you point out, that's the tougher part. So when you're talking about nurse specialists or degreed nurses, that's probably where the university really belongs, is working that. And so I think there's plenty of ground for us to share the task. And then, as our records show as well, once we get nurses, and for that matter, when we get doctors back in, they go back and stay in Alaska at a higher rate than any of the other states we're compared to. So this is a very productive program, and one that I think, along the lines of what you're saying, we can even work better. With regard to the governor's intent to break up deferred maintenance money, and we got the first issue of that $37.5 million. If we go into quite a complex model that shows how our facilities maintenance and operations money and our R&R money and the deferred maintenance all come together, and I think we gave you a chart that shows all that, what you'll see is that to sustain what we have in terms of 6.5 million square feet of floor space at the age that it's aging, and that means new buildings coming in, old buildings getting older, and so that's a variable that changes. When we look at that whole thing, about $50 million a year is what you need in R&R, not O&M, but R&R, to sustain that portion of keeping those buildings up. R&R means, for example, if a building hits, let's say, 25 years, you're going to remodel that building. It gets to the point, just like a home, where you're going to go in and do some major work inside and remodel. That's the R&R level. Some people call it capital maintenance. That's about a $50 million bill. And to keep it at a $50 million bill, you need preventive maintenance working and O&M working for you so that you don't have a lot of R&R. And if you don't do the R&R, it becomes deferred maintenance. And deferred maintenance grows and grows and grows. So the 37.5 was a big chunk of the $50 million we needed in that 1 year. But the total that we needed in that year was about 4% of the adjusted value of the facilities. We were short of that. And so the short part that we came in, which is the short part of O&M and R&R, goes to deferred maintenance. Deferred maintenance went up that year. And that's why we're at about $800 million. Now, we've done that year after year after year after year. And so that line just keeps going up and up as we project it into the future. So the second piece of our problem is to break that deferred maintenance line and get it started back down. You've got to sustain what you've got, but at the same time, you've got to go after that deferred maintenance and get it coming back down, too. If we can get the deferred maintenance back down to about a 10% range and then sustain O&M and R&R, $50 million, $30 million about, another 10 that comes in from the federal dollars, Title III, all together, if there was a way we could project that out into the future, we would never grow deferred maintenance again. We would be able to stay on the steady programmatic line that we could forecast out into the years in the future. And as I mentioned before earlier in the briefing, if there was a way that we could figure out how to get that R&R every year through some kind of an endowment or a return on an investment, instead of having to come in every year and just ask for a chunk of money and then take whatever we get year after year after year, that's kind of what got us where we are. There's a better way if we could afford to do that. So what I've told you is kind of what's on that chart. There's the history. Here's where we are now, what we're trying to do to break that line. And then here's what the possibilities look like if we were to do it different in the future.
On that point, before we get to Senator Stedman, you've requested, the $37 million for deferred maintenance. Your list of projects is three-quarters of $1 billion, and then you list that you have in the blue book prioritized by campus, and then between campuses, how do you prioritize which projects you're going to fund? Because obviously decisions are going to have to be made on the allocation of that $37 million between campuses, and I think that's an issue that this table would like to have addressed so that we know that different areas of the state are being addressed.
Mr. Chair, great question, because the history shows that over about the past 10 years, most of the money that's been given to us has gone to new construction. And the money, and that's probably 75%, 73%, something like that. The remaining dollars, a lot of those have gone not to new construction, but to additions or renovations of a major proportion. So the actual amount that went into pure R&R was very low. So in this program of deferred maintenance emphasis, what I did was I went out to the chancellors and I said, including your community campuses, because they're very much a part of this, I would like to know what are the most urgent deferred maintenance issues that you have. I didn't give them a dollar figure. I didn't give them a number or a percentage, top 10, or I just said, give me the ones that are the highest risk. And so these came back sort of unencumbered by anything other than, in their estimation, in their facilities people's estimation, risk. Now, one of the nice things about the community campus is Title III has been at work to the tune of several million dollars a year, and that has really made a lot of difference in many of our community campuses, which means we didn't have to come here for those dollars, and they've done very, very well with those dollars. So those aside, there are other community campuses that also had risk and had deferred maintenance. I received the list back, and I counted up out of that list, which was about 40, as I recall off the top of my head, it was about 45 total projects. And I added those up, and it came to just under $100 million. And said, if we could get $100 million, we could buy out that entire 45 project across the entire system and reduce the overall risk of mission failure. I mean, literally buildings shutting down, that's mission failure, or dorms shutting down. We could reduce that risk significantly and break that curve like I was talking about that you can see on this chart that I gave you, how it starts to come back down. That was what was at the heart of this budget. And so instead of asking for anything new for this year and possibly even the next year while we see what our economy is going to do, we turned around and went after the biggest problem that we have, sort of blinders off. And I used the chancellor's inputs from across the system to make sure that we included community campuses as well as the main campuses. That's the process we used.
But then how is the $37 million going to be divided between UA Anchorage campus, UAA community campuses? You know, you have several different categories in here, and they seem to be prioritized, but is there a process that you're going to be using to decide how this $37 million, if we give that to you, is spent?
Well, if we got the budget the way we were asking for it, every one of them would be covered, so that we wouldn't have to prioritize them and just pick and choose. As I said before, if I got the money for the 45 and you know, 100 million of that would come from bonding instead of coming in for an appropriation, we would try to do it through a bonding process. So when I add the 37.5 onto the 100 million and then the Title III money that comes in for that year, I would cover those 45 projects, and every one of them would get bought out. So you'd have small businesses and contractors all over Alaska, in literally every town that we had a campus going to work these projects.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a brief comment before I go into my question. I think it would deserve some discussion at the table, Mr. Chairman, the whole concept of bonding for maintenance. I think we've taken a look at that, dealing with DOT here. So it has some residual implications of items being wore out before the bonds are even paid off. But anyway, with that, we can leave that for a later date, Mr. Chairman. But just looking through the book here, you know, at fairly high level, looking at the back of the blue cover and just doing some rates of change, Mr. Chairman, looks like the expenditures and the revenues of from 07 through the budget year 12 is, you know, expenditures are roughly a rate of change of about 4.6 a year, and then revenues at about 4.6, and the numbers in the middle kind of change a little bit. But basically 4.5% a year is rates of change for the university, which is all well and good, but my question is, I'm a little bit concerned or interested in down in the Southeast campus, if we take a look on page 55, Bottom of page 55, they've got Juneau, Ketchikan, and Sitka broken out as University of Southeast. And the authorized budget by campuses, but, you know, if you take Ketchikan in 09, it's $4.9 million, and budget year 12 is $4.9 million. You can round that up to $5 million, I guess. And Sitka, starting in 09 at 7.9 and ending at 7.3, and that's definitely backwards. But then I flip down a couple more pages to page 58, and it has the headcount by academic organization, and Sitka in 05 went from, well, we just moved the numbers up, I guess, to match this blue page here at 07, so we use 07 numbers, 834 to 1,000. And then Ketchikan went from 480 to 571. So that's, to me, that's showing some growth down there. But I look at their budget numbers, and their budget numbers look like they're shrinking. And then I go to page 64, and I'm not quite sure how to interpret page 64, just, you know, from the high-level view, you look at these on the total column on the state appropriation summary by category, the lowest numbers are Ketchikan and Sitka at 1.1, and the only other numbers lower that with the rates of change are statewide and system-wide, and all the other regions, you know, are showing growth. And I'm just kind of curious on why it appears that the revenue is in decline. At the same time, it appears that the headcount is escalating. And again, I'm just looking through this book at these different charts, so I was wondering if you can help us with that.
Michelle?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman.
Mr. Chairman, before she answers the question, I'd prefer to have the answer not by just reducing the students to make the revenue grow, but go ahead.
For the specifics on the amount of budget decreases, I'll need to get back with the campus on that, on the operating budget, and get you a response on that. But the growth in student credit hours in those areas have been primarily due to distance education. So that's the source for that. And related to your last question on the state appropriate, on page 64, that just reflects state appropriation. And as we mentioned previously, Ketchikan and Sitka have been doing a good job at receiving Title III funds. So the majority of, or actually all of their needs, as you'll note in the request for this year for major maintenance, has been taken care of through those Title III funds.
Minister Stedman?
Yes, I recognize the lack of those two campuses on the major maintenance list because, for one thing, they're a lot smaller. So when we worked on maintenance items the last few years, it, you know, it didn't take them long to get caught up in the major weight as sitting in Anchorage and Fairbanks, and I certainly understand that. But the concern wasn't so much with the maintenance dollars and that stuff, was just the operating side. I recognize it is a small percentage of the university, you know, in an area of the state with declining population, but clearly there's been more use in southeast of the University of Alaska to try to retool and educate the communities down here, the citizens, so we can try to turn this declining population situation and economy around.
And the comment that I would make is that because an area has a lot of native population and get federal funds, they should not be looked at as taken care of by the state. They are still state citizens, and should those areas of the state should be treated accordingly. You know, they're voters, they're a population base, and just because they are entitled to funds from the federal government, that should not be held against them for support from the state of Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, if I may make a comment on that. One of the pleasures of this job is the ability to go around and visit the campuses, which I have not been on in the past, and meet the directors and meet the faculty and staff. And when I was in the Air Force, I mean, I did a lot of visiting to dispersed operating units and talking to commanders, and one of the things I would always look for is what kind of shape are the facilities in, and then I would ask, what do you need? You know, I'm your resource guy. If you don't tell me what you need, I can't get it for you. What do you need? And I'm delighted to say that at some of the campuses I visited, they've done an amazing job with the Title III money. And when I've asked that question to the directors, what do you need, I don't get the answer that I need a roof or I need an addition or I need this or that. I mean, they seem to be very forthcoming in terms of the fact that we went out and we got the Title III money, and they put that Title III money to good use, and they're very, very happy with the conditions that that they're receiving. So the community campuses are going to be an essential part of where we're going to go in our five-year plan. They're the kind of the crown jewel in terms of solving some of our problems. But for the ones that get Title III, I must say they've put the money to awful good use because they've done some great things with it.
And if I were there in Bethel and on the campus and the federal government came in and said, we're going to do this and do this and do this, they obviously are going to respond saying, yes, that is very good. We appreciate what is happening. But if asked, is there additional needs that the state of Alaska should be doing, maybe you would get an additional answer. Ms. Redmond.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to make a couple of comments in response to the last discussion. First of all, Title III is not just a handout. There is a competitive quality to it. So our campuses have done an absolutely excellent job of defining what their needs are and going after their share of that money. But one of the things in Southeast that isn't evident from the numbers, and Senator Stedman, we will get you a lot more detail on that, but the nursing programs, which are handled in Juneau, Sitka, and Ketchikan, the funding for those programs shows up in the UAA budget because they're programs that are delivered from the Anchorage campus. So in order to really reflect some of the program activity that's happening in those communities, we need to kind of pick that up, and I'd be happy to add that to the list.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, that'd be nice, Mr. Chairman. I think the more clarity we have, the better it is for us making the correct decision at the end of the day.
But I think that I'm going to have my staff ask those campuses, are they happy with those appropriations, but are there additional needs out there if they were to get some attention and ask if there was other projects that the state... if the state had additional dollars or they were being treated like other areas of state and their allocations, what would they do with them? Maybe they'll respond to me.
They would, sir, and I will tell you that they do have additional needs in terms of growth, in terms of priorities, the pressing need, something is really broken and needs fixing or something that's not allowing the students to really receive the proper environment for the learning that they're involved with. That's the kind of thing I'm referring to, but when I was at a couple of the campuses, I mean, if you ask them, okay, what's next, what would you like to have, there's always something on the shopping list, clearly. And if there were extra money to come in, I know exactly where I would go in places like Nome or one or two of the other campuses where the directors have said, you know, on our plan, the next thing we would like to do is this. And when we said that we were going to do a no growth as far as our budget submission, those were the things that were not on the list. They are on the list for deferred maintenance, though.
And my point is that they, just because they're receiving Title III funds, that issue should not be held against them.
Yeah.
And they should be treated as state citizens and should receive state dollars. Please proceed. Senator Sedman.
Mr. Chairman, while we're on that subject, and before we move off, just maybe we can reflect on page 57. I'm just curious, maybe you can help us with that. This deals with, for those watching at home, as a student credit hours by academic organization. But there's some rates of change from 05 to 010, and it's showing Fairbanks down negative 1.2%. And Anchorage up 8.8. Is 05 an anomaly, the number? in the 05 column, so Fairbanks is actually showing a growth from 06 from 46.7 to 48.9 thousand. Or can you help me with interpreting that? Because it's kind of curious, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. President.
Senator Stedman, I think we're probably, it's going to take us some time to noodle that, and I think we probably best give you, see if we can give you an answer for the record on that. I don't think either one of us or any of us here have a quick answer for that one.
That's fine, Mr. Chairman. They can get back to us. I just want to keep up, because I'm quite a bit removed from the Anchorage and Fairbanks campuses, so it'd help have a better feel for what's going on as we work through their situations.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. We're on page 12, Mr. President.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we can move on to page 13. The focus academically or programmatically, if you will, outside of facilities and those kinds of things, the focus for the next 5 years in our strategic planning and in our program reviews and those kinds of functions is to maintain our core mission, which is to get students through. I like to say, if I can get more students through to graduation or to completion faster, those three elements right there do a lot of things. They reduce student debt load, they reduce the cost per graduate to the university, and they enhance our mission, which is education and getting students out into the workforce with whatever level they're interested in pursuing. So our emphasis has been for almost 10 years now, we've put a lot of emphasis on getting students in the door. And that has, in the growth in that area, particularly in distance learning or e-learning or whatever name you'd like to use now, because it's not so much distance anymore, it's just learning. And it's just another way we do it, and it's probably a third of everything we do in the system now is e-learning. The point being here, though, that we need to retain students, not just get them in the door, but retain them past that first year, and there's where our numbers start to fall down. Our graduation rates at every level are not good. That's a complex issue. It involves going all the way back into junior high school, working with our school districts, working with our superintendents, working with our own faculty, and particularly, I think, my personal opinion is that a strong component in the fix in all this is going to be enhancing the capability of our community campuses to do even more than they're doing now. They're very nimble, very flexible, and very able. The MAUs are not near as flexible. And I think we can also work with the high schools because there's a lot of pressure being put on them by this body and others to do a better job as well. And if we can get all those together, that education continuum, we're going to get people past the first year in college at a greater rate. Just by improving attrition rates, we reduce the cost per graduate, we reduce the debt load, and we make even our facilities more efficient. If you build a church for Easter Sunday and half the kids drop out, and then the rest of them take 7 years to graduate, you've got more juniors and seniors than you have freshmen after 1 year. And I've never seen a system exactly quite like that, but that's what we're looking at in some departments. I think that can be worked, and I think if we put the emphasis on that we put on getting students in the door into our system over the last 10 years, we can show similar improvement in getting them out the door and getting them out the door faster as well, and maintaining a higher percentage of them in the coursework and not having them drop out.
Mr. Chairman, if I might.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. General, if I could just ask you, are we doing exit interviews through the counseling staff or professors or others with the freshmen that are leaving the campus? And if you're not, I just really encourage you to do that. I'd like to see a pie chart that shows whether those freshmen are moving on to other campuses. I know that is a fact, that a lot of Alaska students will use the university system as a stepping stone as a freshman year, sophomore year, beginner placement because it's less expensive, and I think that's fantastic, and then go on and get that graduation degree from another school. In that case, I want to see that those numbers, but for those that are dropping out of the system, why? Is it they feel that they're not keeping up, they don't have the support? Is it that the cost of education itself is exceeding the tuition? And that's one other concern that I've been hearing from students in my district, is that while you might be able to get a scholarship for the school itself, the cost of actual living and then trying to find housing is so expensive that students are finding they end up getting into waitressing and other jobs and simply have to drop out. But I'm curious to know what data you have.
Mr. Chair, if I may respond to that, the data that we have is not complete data. One of the issues we've discovered is that in order to go in and examine these problems in a way that we haven't done before, we're finding holes in the data that won't allow us to continuously track a student, or more important, continuously track a group of students back to where they were. We can point to places where they were either exceptionally successful, which aided in success in the future, or things broke down, which clearly points to where there was a problem that they didn't recover from before they were unsuccessful in the university system. We need to have that data. I'll give you another example. When a student enters into the school system in Alaska, they're assigned a student number. When they leave the school system in 12th grade and come to us, we give them a new number for our own system. And so we can't track back into high school to find out which high schools, which teachers, which courses, and that's what we need to do to really go after the kinds of things I was mentioning before. Our data is incomplete. The good news is we're recognizing that and taking action and working with, I just had a meeting with two of our larger superintendent districts to try to see how we can come together with our freshman coursework and our junior senior coursework at the high school level to include our data system tracking. There are some freedom of information issues and public privacy issues and all the sort of legal things. Those can be worked. We just haven't done it in the past. But if we argue that school is a continuum, then we need to be able to track data through the continuum. And right now, the data is broken, truncated. The non-standard student, the one you mentioned that leaves us, let's say they, for whatever reason, they leave us after the first year. 5 years later, they come back into our system. We don't necessarily know that that's the same student. And why they left, but they come back in, they're more mature, maybe they've got a job, they pay for their education, they graduate, and they go out. We listed them as a failure back here, but we don't list them as a success up here. And we're developing some data system applications to try to be able to track that. The average student is no longer the four and go student, as you all well know. And our data systems do not track the non-standard student or the one that returns, and maybe returns a couple, two or three times, gets a certificate, gets a license, gets a two-year degree, and 5 years later gets a four-year degree. We don't know all about that student.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. And just one follow-up for the general as well. If you think about some kind of an exit interview questionnaire that you'd be asking a student that would allow them to voluntarily tell you some things about their life, why they're leaving, if it's financial pressure, change in marital status, change in educational pursuits, etc. I think that could be helpful. If it's a housing issue, inability to afford school because of housing or additional expenses. And then another part of it that I think would be interesting to explore, Mr. Chairman, is we do have, obviously, the rural campuses in your neck of the woods and certainly in Southeast, but we also have rural students that come into the Anchorage campus and the Fairbanks campus, and I'm curious to know, do they feel welcome? Do they feel, for example, at my school at Willamette, a lot of student organizations were formed around sort of welcoming and making Alaskans and Hawaiians in particular feel at home, because it is a long way from home. Is it a lack of cultural identity? Is there a feeling or a sense that there isn't mentoring? So those kinds of things I would be curious to know. As you said, we're putting so much money and investing at the forefront. I'd sure like to see us succeed. And if it's something little like that along the way where we could really promote some of that community involvement, that support for the student to get them over that first year hump where it seems insurmountable. I'd sure like to see us do that. So any feedback you have, it would be welcome.
Thank you, Senator McGuire. If you could refer to page 27, you have a chart here on performance and results and targets that we've been talking about. The first one is relating to high demand jobs, and you give the growth by numbers, but it doesn't give us the retention. But the second one talks about graduate retention by campus, and those are percentages. But what are the percentages for the high demand jobs? And, you know, I think we're looking at apples and oranges here, and if we could get that so we have an understanding of how we're doing on retention of high demand job graduates. And the other area, how are the campuses, rural campuses, doing? You know, are they of concern or they're not concerned, so we don't report them here?
Mr. Chair, we'll get you that information. I've seen that information. We have a lot that's not in this book, and I'm sure we have it actually done up, and we'll get that for you.
Again, when we go over information here, it would be good to feel that someone looking at this document has information regarding rural campuses, and they feel that they're part of the system. Ms. Redmond.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just take a moment, I think I can answer now that I've had a chance to look at the page that Senator Stedman brought up on page 57. I can answer your question at this point easily, quickly. Unfortunately, there aren't lines drawn here, Senator Stedman, but if you draw a line after where it says PWSCC on the left-hand side, and draw a line all the way across, and if you draw a line underneath where it says UAF Community Technical all the way across, and a line after Sitka all the way across, the chart is easier to read. And what you're seeing in here for Anchorage, that's the UAA campus, their overall change from 09 to 10, or let's take 2005 to 2010, was 11.8%. For Fairbanks, where Fairbanks campus is down by 1.2%, but overall they were up by 9.7%, all of that growth was in the rural campuses. In Southeast, Ketchikan was down a little bit, but Sitka was up by 28.4%, so their overall average change from 05 to 10 was 8.2%. So again, the rural campuses brought up the average for the overall MAU.
Senator Stedman?
No, I don't. That's fine.
Great. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may make a comment on that.
Mr. President.
Something else to look for, I think, that we're kind of excited about is when the bandwidth increases to the communities and the rural campuses, so that we're not talking about satellite-sized bandwidth, and as I understand it, the consortium that is working that may have actually signed an agreement last week in Washington to try to run that fiber optic up around the coast, up to the north side. When that reaches the community campuses, and anybody in the community campus can have the same bandwidth as anybody in Anchorage, I think we're going to see a flood of this e-learning or distance learning rearrange where credit hours are being taken and where students are going to go for their education. And it's going to get into the middle of these numbers where we look at headcount and we look at credit hours. There's going to be a rearrangement. And we're going to have to accommodate that because it also affects how we measure tuition, credit. Who pays for credit hours when a student in their dorm room in Fairbanks, and this goes for about 30% of them as much as we know right now, about 30% of them are in their dorm room at Fairbanks taking an online course, either in Fairbanks or somewhere else. And when we get the bandwidth all the way up into the villages and the need to have to even go to a community campus is reduced for certain kinds of education, This whole mix is going to change. And over the next 5 years, we've got to figure out how we're going to accommodate to that and how we're going to report it, because it's going to get more and more confusing. Used to be you had to go sit in the classroom and head count was really easy to measure. It's getting more and more complicated.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as that subject was brought up, and we are looking forward to the fiber optics going up western Alaska's coast, but currently in southeast we've got Ketchikan, Petersburg, Wrangell, and Sitka, and Juneau all connected to fiber. And my concern is, and maybe you can get back to me on that, check with the Ketchikan and the Sitka campus, and for that matter the Juneau campus, to see if there's any bottlenecks in accessing that fiber. I have been told that there's some contractual issues of agreements that they have to wait until the clock runs out before they can fully be accessed, and I think it'd be nice for us to know if there's any bottlenecks that is blocking the ability of the campuses to fully utilize the bandwidth that's brought into those communities.
I'm not aware of any right now off the top of my head, but we'll get that information for you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I think on chart number 13 we've covered those other bullets, so I'll go to 14. And the point I'd like to make here is, despite talk about flat budgets and cutting back and program reviews and deferred maintenance and so on and so forth, as we've just talked about here a second ago, there's some real opportunities out in front of us. And I don't want to lose sight of the fact that we have had successful growth. We've got those students that are still beating on the doors, wanting to come in, wanting an education across an entire spectrum of education. And that's what we're all about. And so the opportunities that I've listed here are the kinds of things that we want to keep uppermost in our mind as we go forward. And as if we keep the students' perspective in mind, the students at every location, and look at things through student eyes as well as through our own, I think we'll have a better balance of the ability to go in and take advantage of some of the things that are listed on this slide. These are all areas that are of interest to the state of Alaska, and that's what we're all about. So whatever we do in the strategic plan, the idea is to try to, as much as possible, preserve the interest in these areas. And even if we have to take a strategic pause of some sort, we're not going to slow down teaching our kids, teaching our students, adults that are coming back, and supporting those programs. The only thing that would challenge us in that area, and I was asked this question before, is, you know, what happens if, as the third largest bill that you probably pay in the entire state, you have to come back and make some of the cuts like they've made in the lower 48, where they've raised tuition three times in a year. I think in California, they're like, I read the other day, there are 20,000 students who no longer can go to class, who would like to go to class because universities have cut down so much in their programs. We're not there yet, and hopefully we'll never get there. And I was asked, well, what would you do? And my answer was, there's only so many things you can do, and if you look at what the schools in the lower 48 have done, it would be the same for us. But if we had to collapse around those kinds of, under those circumstances, the collapse would occur around those cores that we've been discussing here around the table here this morning. We would still have fiber optic. We would still have the capability to teach students and put them into the workforce. And it would just be that the number of programs would fall to those that are the highest demand. And that's what we would intend to do. So as we look forward in strategic planning, that's the kind of thing we're going to have to be thinking about.
So what are the areas of reduction that other campuses are doing in Lower 48, less concentration on research?
Well, research dollars come mostly from the federal government. Although there are state research dollars, most of the research dollars come from the federal government, and they bring with them credit dollars that can be applied as revenue for the university. In our case, I intend to go after much more research for that very reason, because research not only brings in, it also brings attention from outside. For example, if we're in remotely piloted vehicles, or if we're in supercomputing, or if we're in nanotechnology, or some of those areas, there are a lot of companies who are very, very interested in that, and it has commercial spin-off opportunities for the university as well. That's additional revenue from additional sources. looking for additional sources of revenue would become primary in, under circumstances like that, and research has the opportunity to provide one of those additional sources of revenue. So I see that as very important. But those high-demand jobs we talked about before and the high-demand degree areas that we discussed before would be the ones that we would collapse around.
Sorry. Please proceed.
One of our chancellors made the comment on the last slide, as I get off the stage here, that a maintenance budget really means maintenance of momentum, maintenance of quality programs for students, and maintenance of service to the state. If we fail in those, we failed in doing our job. So that's our bottom line. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Three other areas that I'd like to briefly hit upon. I've heard that ANSAP was viewed as a one-time appropriation, and I know we addressed that at the conference table, and that was not the intent, and we need to get at that. Is that not the case?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding it wasn't a one-time appropriation. It was ongoing funding, so, but we'll get back to you on that.
The other area that I would like to get supplemental information on is during the course of the summer, the Budget and Audit Committee approved several millions of dollars in stimulus, and if we can get a report on where those dollars were spent and what was purchased because of the busy summer, that was sort of a contentious issue, but I think we worked through that, but we're not able to get into much detail on where those stimulus dollars went. And the final one, if you could talk about the health science building and how that is incorporated in this budget. I believe the opening of that facility is scheduled for August, sometime in August. And if you could address that opening and how the funding of that is being implemented in this budget.
Mr. Chair, on the last one, the opening's on schedule. We received in our budget dollars for operating and maintenance costs. We did not receive dollars for additional staff. That's the one area we're looking at that still is sort of up in the air, is trying to get a handle on what and how many additional and types of staff would be needed. The rest of the project, though, is in pretty good shape.
Further question, Senator McGuire, then Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have three questions, if that's okay.
Yes.
Mr. General, hi. Good morning again. Three questions for you. The first is unrelated to the other two. Looking on page 53 in the blue book, we were just talking about this morning. In fiscal year 09, there was $210,076,000 spent on instruction and $116,814,000 spent on what was called institutional support, executive administration, and another $42,365,600 on academic administration. And just overall, this is my first year on finance, I'm looking at the ratio of administrative dollars spent versus classroom instruction. And it seems to me like an overall 35,000-foot view looks like the university spends about a dollar for every $2 in instruction, a dollar on administration. And I'd just like to hear a little bit of the philosophy that you have behind that, what you've done to shave that off, put more in the classroom, or change that, or what direction you're going there.
Mr. President?
I don't have a quick answer for that. I mean, I'll defer to my colleagues on both sides, but of all the things I've looked at right now, I have not gone into a ratio like that, which is actually pretty common in business to look at something like that, compare it with other peer institutions, look at exactly what those dollars are spent on. I have not engaged in that exercise on an institutional-wide scale yet. I'm looking at my own staff right now to start in that same process. Strategic planning process, when we do program review, when we do institutional review, and we start asking for data in some areas where we're lacking data, this is the kind of thing from a budgetary point of view or from a financial point of view, much like a business, we would naturally get into and start doing that kind of analysis. I'm not aware that it's been done like that up to this point in time, and so I don't have a numerical answer or any comparisons that I can give you right now.
Thank
Senator
you.
McGuire.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, very much. So I have two more questions, but just to follow up on this, I appreciate your candor, and I look forward to the response, and I think it's helpful for the committee as we move forward in guiding us about the direction of the university. Certainly, I am a big fan of the small schoolhouse in the middle of America or wherever else, and a great teacher, and a few books shared among classes, and boy, you can go a long way. And I think it's really important, especially as you come back with this look about what's happening in terms of retention and our students that are not progressing from that freshman year on in the academic support and institutional support in particular. It may involve transferring some of our administrative folks from jobs that they're in right now into jobs that they need to be into to support the students and the mission that we have here in our state of keeping our students educated and getting them through the system. Second question I have, if I might, Mr. Chairman. On page 26 of your Fisher report, in fiscal year 2009, that's a Fisher report that you did, the system spent $78.4 million on items labeled as technology. This was 11% of the system's total expenditures, as represented as a 93% increase since fiscal year 1999. That's great. The Fisher report itself asks about the effectiveness of this spending throughout the university system. What is the university system doing to get a better understanding of how effective technology spending is? And I'd like to know, if you have the answer today, that'd be great. If not, get back to me, and then I have one more question after that.
Well, Fisher's question was somewhat rhetorical because he's actually lobbing that softball over to us to ask us, have you tracked this or measured this? And what I can say is, you know, a lot of those dollars went into improvement of our whole IT system. And from what I've seen, it's a very good one that's grown and been very productive, and it's one that probably will remain as a system-wide function as opposed to those things that could be pushed back down to the campuses, which is going to be one of the things I'll be looking very much to be able to do, is push responsibility back to the campuses where it's better served by the individual chancellors at the campuses instead of putting it all up at the system level. That gets to your administration issue, for example. But something as umbrella-like as IT, particularly with the transition that we've gone through in about the last 10 years, where the growth in IT quite often has not been controlled, and I've been in several organizations where we've come back to figure out, hey, what have we got here, and how did we get where we are, and is it efficient? It's a kind of a classic question these days, because when you look back at the amount of money you've spent, everybody's got a computer. We refresh them about every 3 years. We do things like consolidate servers and build server farms and do all this stuff, which is supposed to make things more efficient. And measuring efficiency in IT is something that's very difficult to do. Fisher's asking us a question there. He's saying, well, how are you guys measuring it? Well, you can take a look around and see that distance learning, the ability to register online and to improve that process every year, make it more seamless, put more of our administration online, less administration positions. If we went back and looked at all that, we've done that too, like corporations have, and the military, for example, has done the same thing. In terms of measuring that and creating a metric of efficiency, I would have to go back and get some data for you to see if we've done that. I know of one study at least that's tried to do that, but it might be a little outdated. But it's a great question. It's kind of a classic question too.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate once again the candor. And again, this is our first meeting of the whole on the university budget, so it's not meant to be a Trump question or anything like that. I mean, these are just questions as we go through. I have a particular interest, my final question, in patenting and in licensing and technology, and a viewpoint that our university could be one of the best in the United States. I really think that. UCLA is a leader in this in particular, and we've spent time in our office looking at their Office of Intellectual Property and Commercialization, which is right on their campus and accessible. You have that at the Fairbanks campus as well. And I'm going to ask the questions. I've written it out just so it sits on the record. But according to the Association of University Technology Managers in 2009, in their survey, federally funded research at universities has led to the creation of 596 new companies, 658 new products, 12,109 patent applications. Universities also received $2.3 billion in licensing revenue from previous technology commercialization. So on that point, how much revenue so far has the University of Alaska system received from licensing revenue? How much does the university compare to its peers in terms of technology commercialization? And finally, is there a strategic plan? And if not, I'd like to see one, please, to improve technology commercialization and innovation at the university system.
Mr. President.
Senator, if we've made any money, I'm not aware of it. I go back about 10 years on this subject with the University of Alaska at Anchorage when I was an advisor to the dean of the business school, who had an initiative to try to use RFID tags and our nanotechnology research, put those two together and compress these tags down to where they're active tags that are very, very small. Great idea. 10 years ago, it was a great idea. Today, we're doing it. We didn't do it. It's just happening. The university at that time just simply wasn't in the business of looking at commercialization. When I was being interviewed for my job here, I made the point at all the interviews that I'm very, very interested in starting this up. And we have since hired a new leadership team on a research side at UAF. The deputy is quite experienced in this area. We have an economic development office at UAA. And the dean of the business school there is also quite experienced in this area and is itching to move forward on this. Now, I think, and I will have to vet this through my staff and through the faculty and so on, I think that's a system-wide responsibility. I think we need to take the burden off the researchers and all that administrative work that you mentioned, patents and going out and getting dollars, investments, and then figuring out what's our share of it and putting that in policy and all that work needs to come off the researchers. We need to take that over for them. So I would like to move an Office of Intellectual Property Development into my staff and work it from there on the administrative side and then let the research go do what they can do to come up with the ideas. Now, I, too, have looked at other universities. I've looked at their dollars. I've looked at their success. We're out talking to them and trying to figure out what's the best model for the University of Alaska. I am absolutely all for this.
Excellent.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator McGuire. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If I could just back up a little bit and maybe ask a little higher level as far as the view dealing with some of our deferred maintenance issues. I think in the governor's submission, there's $37.5 million for maintenance. The request here from the university is to bump that up $100 million from what I kind of gather from the presentation, but I'm a little bit curious and for background information, just looking, there's page 61 talks about the number of buildings and the square footage and the age and so on and so forth, and then back on page 58 talks about the headcount issue. And again, not being as familiar with the Anchorage and the Fairbanks campus as the ones in Southeast, looks like Anchorage has 60 buildings, and then Fairbanks has a number somewhat higher than that, with basically 50% more square feet. I'm just kind of curious if we can get a kind of a head count comparison to building square footages and size to make sure that we're putting the effort in the campuses going forward at where the growth is or where the need is. For instance, Sitka has one building that's 68 years old, which is in pretty good shape. So it's kind of an anomaly within the list.
but you know, not being from Anchorage or Fairbanks, I just want to get a better feel for how many students are on the campus, what's the size of the infrastructure there. If we have these old buildings, you know, should we really be retrofitting them, or should we be tearing them down and consolidating them, or what should we be doing to advance the university going forward? And I'm not talking about, Mr. Chairman, moving students from one campus to the other, just, you know, are we efficient in our building, the buildings the way they're spread out in their age, and as we concentrate on this big maintenance bill, do we want to try to do any consolidations or modifications?
Mr. President.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure Kit is online to make sure that we understand that question. And we do keep track of our space by use. So I think what you're asking for is to look at classroom space by campus compared to classroom space at other campuses, separate from research space or storage space. Am I understanding correctly?
Well, you could break it, Mr. Chairman. They could break it down that way, but total space also. And I recognize that, like in the Sitka's case, they've got one building. Fairbanks obviously has that one big heat plant. So you can't do a direct comparison. And I'm not really after that. Just I want to get a better feel for, you know, where the students are and what kind of infrastructure do we have. And if we're running a bunch of buildings that age-wise are very old, or, you know, do we want to fix those buildings up, or do we want to have some consolidation of buildings?
Thank you, sir.
And maybe that's already been, the process might have already, you know, been done, but I just want a little better feel, because this is a about $1 billion request as we march down it, so we want to make sure if we start heading down that road, you know, we end up where we want to be at the end, and we don't end up with a lot of buildings that maybe we should have done something different with.
Mr. President, no comments?
I certainly agree with the Senator. Tearing down a building, no matter how old it is and how dilapidated, it's been my experience, nobody ever wants to do that. Eliminating floor space, and we have to, as opposed to repurpose everything when it's vacated and go back and redo it. The fly in the ointment, and the thing that's going to be interesting to see as we look and try to forecast the next 5 years, is if we get back to that distance learning, there are more and more and more students who don't have to go sit in a classroom, and we don't know exactly how that's going to impact things like dorms. And so if we miss, we could run the risk of building a lot of extra square footage that in the future, with more and more online and Fidelity online, we're actually going to see a reduction, but the credit hours go up because they're not in the classrooms and they're not in the dorms because they're sitting at home, and a lot of kids would choose to do that. We're always going to have students that are going to come in and sit in class. But what we're seeing now is we have choices, and trying to forecast what the choices are going to do to how many actually come in the door or what kind of combination of courses they take with us is going to be a problem, and it'll have a direct effect on your concern and your question. So I think the other variable we're going to have to look at as we answer your question is look at how the credit hours have also increased and figure out how much of that is going to go to e-learning as opposed to being able to just have a two-part variable, floor space and headcount.
Thank you for those comments. I would like to thank the university. We requested a report on small-scale modular nuclear power for Alaska, and we did receive the report from Gwen Holman, who's the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, and there's some recommendations in here for further consideration, and we will be discussing that at this table as well. But the primary request for this was that there really isn't a solution that exists today for the high cost of energy in rural areas of the state for heating, and they continue to rely upon high diesel costs, and there is no end in sight for those costs to be reduced. So I do appreciate the report, and I'll be making a copy of that for the committee and for anyone else that would like it and would like to work with with the committee on the recommended future scope, because it says in the report that we need to be at the forefront of the issue, especially with Obama reopening the question of nuclear power in the United States. And I think that that us monitoring that and following the developments in that regard as it works through FERC and our interests are a lot smaller in scale, so we need to make sure that the smaller scaled power plants are addressed, because at this point I don't see any real major solution for heating costs. There are a lot of solutions being discussed for reducing electrical costs, but I just wanted to inform the committee and thank the for that report. And I would open for any closing comments by members before I ask for closing comments by the president. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just two quick items. One is back again on the deferred maintenance and how that spreads out in the community. I think it's important, an important statistic. You know, the high percentage of contractors and Alaskan residents hired on those particular jobs, I think, is a great selling point, and obviously something that we should consider as we look at the university in many lights. And one is an economic engine, you know, of keeping communities working. So there's certainly that, as well as training those workers. And the second thing is that if you could put together a short page anyhow that would indicate the average debt load for University of Alaska 4U graduates from 2001 to 2011, just a breakdown of the increased costs for students for tuition, room and board, those types of things, so we can see how that's kind of stacking up. Those issues come up as we discuss the scholarship program is probably the most current. Thank you.
And with that, I'd like to thank you, and do you have any closing comments for the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I'd just like to thank the committee for their interest in the detail in which you've asked some really good questions. We've got some homework here that actually will aid us in getting some of the information based on the questions you've asked. Thank you for your consideration, and thank you for the support of the university that you've clearly shown all the way through our entire system to our community campuses, which again, I think we do have a very bright future ahead of us, but it's going to take the entire system to do it, and if I can fix some of those things and reduce some of that risk, the rest of it, I think, will go very, very well. And we've got the message about being more efficient and about growth, and we'll keep that very closely in mind as we build our strategic plan. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And for tomorrow, the Finance Committee meeting on the budget is going to be postponed till a later date. We have had a scheduling conflict, and we'll get back and figure out what our schedules are and bring that up. But I just wanted to inform the committee that we don't have anything at this time. A brief at ease. And with that, we will be adjourned.